yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as I promised at the end of the show last week, today we're going to deal with the Trump budget. Oh, what a budget. You won't believe some of the details in that budget. I'm not just talking about the cuts. I'm talking about the assumptions and the accounting ledger domain and all the nonsense. This is this is such an indication of the incompetence of this administration. Let's move on to that eventually here. I want to say a few things in terms of topics here. Next week, we're going to start a four-part series on central banks. I'm going to talk about the Fed and the other global central banks, the ECB, the European version, the Bank of England, Bank of Japan, and the People's Bank of China, these five major central banks. This is part of a release of my new book coming out in a couple weeks called Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes. Yes, it's a thorough analysis of central banking and a very critical one. That maintains that the primary functions of central banks have been failing here, especially in the last several decades, but truly in the whole history of central banking, they have not performed very well, and they're performing even worse. The book will look at central bank evolution in the U.S., the attempt to create a central bank in the U.S. back in its early histories under Hamilton, Alexander, that is, you know, that darling of the bankers and the corporate elites. They love this guy. They even made a play about him, and that's his selling, you know, tickets, hot tickets in New York called Hamilton. Yeah, they love they love their heroes, and of course he is a hero of American capitalism, the first hero, in fact. Anyway, enough on Hamilton. But anyway, we'll look at the first and second bank of the U.S. that failed as central banks. We'll look at attempts to create central banking functions after that, which failed. The Federal Reserve, which was created in 1913, and you know, they even refused to call it a central bank because central banks have such a bad rep. They call it Federal Reserve. Does that sound like a central bank? No. Well, that helped them get it passed and fool folks what the central bank was really all about, which is about bailing out the private banks. That's the number one function. They call it lender of last resort. The Fed was created to bail out the banks. It was created by the bankers themselves to bail out, and it was run by the bankers, and still is, a lot more indirectly than ever before. But, you know, when the Fed was created, who were the people who were on the committees, both in the districts, federal districts? You know, 12 of them were created, and in the Washington the board there, they were bankers. Yeah, bankers deciding on how to benefit bankers. Anyway, the book goes on and looks at the failures of the Federal Reserve during the 1920s and its contribution to the Depression of the 30s, and how the Roosevelt administration pushed it aside since it was performing so poorly. But it resurrected in the post-war period, and increasingly as U.S. capital became global, played more and more of a role, especially once Reagan came in, and neoliberalism. It's central banking is a essential element of neoliberalism. Anyway, the book then goes on to look at Greenspan's bank, Volcker's bank, Greenspan's bank, how they failed, and then Bernanke's bank. Oh, did it fail? No, it bailed out the banks. You know, that's the only function it does not fail in, you see, bailing out the banks. Managing the money supply very poorly. Tremendous increase in money supply and liquidity that's led to the financialization of the U.S. and global economy and all these financial instabilities that we have now. You know, that function, failure. Bank supervision, supervising the banks, failure. So the only thing it's good at, which it was created for, was to bail out the banks when they periodically get in trouble, and they always do. And then I look at, in the book, similar failure of performing the basic functions, except for bailouts, by the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and even at that strange hybrid called the People's Bank of China. Which, of course, is kind of in the news. They're talking a lot about China debt. You see, we'll talk about that briefly here, too. Anyway, the theme of the book is that central banks have failed miserably in their avowed primary functions of managing the money supply and supervising private banks and have functioned, I guess, sufficiently in lender of last resort, bailing out the banks when they crash, which they typically do. And in the book, I am predicting we're going to have another financial crash in 3 to 5 years because of the central banks who, when they even bail out the banks, create the preconditions for the next financial crisis by injecting massive liquidity and money into the system that feeds the whole financialization and the instability that we're now experiencing. And by the way, that whole process contributes significantly to slowing real investment. So much liquidity and money, it stimulates financial asset markets and financial investment, but it slows down at the same time real investment, you know, in real things that create real jobs, that hire real people and give them real wage income that keeps the whole thing going. Their central banks are responsible for the slowdown in real growth, which is occurring everywhere, even in China. And they create the preconditions for the next crisis. Anyway, those are the major themes of this book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope. And I'm going to start giving the audience previews of the main arguments starting next week. We'll have a four-point series on that particular topic. Okay. All right, moving on here. What do we got to say about some major events of the past week, U.S. and global economic events, before we get on to the Trump budget? Okay, one thing that's interesting is that OPEC and the Saudis announced an extension of their cuts in production of crude oil. You know, they had announced this last year, and at the time I predicted that's not going to solve anything. Oil prices are going to continue. Crude oil is going to continue to weaken because the global economy continues to weaken. Notwithstanding all the hype and obfuscation that you hear, it's slowing, continuing to slow, and global trade's continuing to slow. Real production is slowing. Not financial, you know, all the money is going into financial speculation. Not all, but a big part of it. You know, look at the stock market. You know, is that based on any fundamentals? No. You know, the Dow is at 2,100 or 21,000 here. It's incredible. You know, it's not based on anything real anymore. Well, that's because the stock markets are run by institutions and what they call quants and indexes, and you know, it has nothing to do anymore, very little to do with real growth and real performance of companies, and prices are being driven by a new financial structure based upon algorithms and institutions and so forth, not fundamentals anymore. Anyway, oil prices have drifted below $50 a barrel once again, as I predicted last year when I said the cuts would not work. And what's the response of the markets to the OPEC and Saudi's announcement of extending the supply cuts? Negative. They don't believe it anymore. So, you know, you should have seen an increase in oil prices if they announced an extension of the cuts. Well, you see a decrease in oil prices. That means, you know, all these cuts are insignificant. They don't mean anything. And global oil prices are going to continue to slide. Now, global oil is not just a commodity. It's a financial asset. And it's a very important financial asset. And there is a close correlation and relationship between global oil prices and the value of the dollar. And we're seeing a weakening of the dollar as we are seeing a decline in global oil prices once again. The Fed is going to announce a rate increase here in June coming up. And, you know, the pundits and economists are saying, well, and the Fed suggested this is the first of several, three of them, we're going to raise rates, three of them this year. The Fed's going to raise rates three times. I'm predicting here it's going to be the last time in 2017 that the Fed will raise rates because the Trump bump economic promise here is not going to materialize, and certainly not to the extent that they thought it would, that business thought it would here when Trump first got elected. You know, all the huff and puff about trillion-dollar infrastructure spending is going to come, you know, and big, massive tax cuts for investors is going to come, et cetera. Well, it's not coming. Right. By the way, in the Trump budget here proposal, you know, during the campaign, he talked about $1 trillion infrastructure spending. Well, you look at the budget, $200 billion. And by the way, $200 billion in infrastructure, at the same time, he's going to cut $100 billion out of the highway program infrastructure. So a net infrastructure stimulus of $100 billion, which is nothing. Nothing. It's not coming, folks. And all this talk about tax cuts, we'll talk about that some more. I don't want to get ahead of myself. You know, that's not going to be realized to the extent that they're talking about either. Well, we'll come to that here shortly. Okay, so oil prices, weakening dollar, and interest rates, and so forth. You know, this is all interesting news, and you know, they are indications that the Trump bump, in other words, the release of the animal spirits here of business investors, is not really going to happen to the degree that they thought. And the impact of that on the stock markets, we'll see in the later part of the year. All right. What other interesting global developments here the past week? Well, the announcement that the Europeans, the Troika, you know, the so-called European Commission, IMF, and the European Central Bank, are close to cutting another deal with Greece. This is Greek Austerity Deal 5.0, as I call it. Why 5.0? Well, we had these big austerity deals in exchange for debt loans by the Troika to the Greek economy, or Greek bankers and Greek central bankers and Greek capitalists mostly, that the workers and people have to pay for. Studies, as I've reported in the past, show that 95% of all the debt payments by the Greeks go to bankers in Northern Europe, 95%. Okay, so the Greeks are cutting pensions, cutting their wages, cutting social benefits, and being squeezed in order to pay the bankers in the north. Yeah, that's essentially what it is. Well, how is this 5.0? Well, we had a big deal, the first in 2010, another one in 2012, austerity deal, and another one here after that in 2015. So we had three big ones. But ever since the third in 2015, every year that the Greeks have to start making a payment back to the banks, to the Troika and the banks, right, in the summer, the Troika forces the Greeks to come up with even more austerity, even more cuts before they release the money. In other words, they agree to a deal in 2015, you got to pay up so much in terms of austerity to pay the interest and principal on these debts that we loan you, to pay interest and principal on previous debts we loaned you. That's essentially the logic. But they come to a deal, but the deal gets opened every spring, the last two springs, last spring in 2016, that was deal 4.0. And again, this spring, 5.0, and they squeeze the Greeks a little bit more. Yeah, each time a debt payment comes up, they open the contract. It's like they agree to a contract, but, oh, no, we want more money, and we're opening the contract. We're going to squeeze you even more every year. Well, when this happened last year, when the Troika forced the Greek government to squeeze its people even more, which it's been more than happy to do, they're covering their own political ass here and stay in power. Called the Syriza government. You know, Syriza was the political party. You know, when this came up last year, prematurely, you see, the bill comes due in July. They got to pay that $7 billion interest. But even before it came up last year in last April, the Troika squeezed the Greeks in another settlement because they didn't want another crisis like 2015 in negotiations before the Brexit vote was pending in Britain, because they didn't know what that was going to mean. So they wanted to get the Greeks into the corral here, and they rounded them up and squeezed them again and settled the deal months before it was due in order to get that put to bed, because, you know, who knows what Brexit would have been. You know, it was all about exiting the Euro European Union, right? And, of course, a lot have been discussing the only solution for Greece is to exit the Eurozone as well. By the way, I wrote a book last October called The Looting Greece. The New Financial Imperialism Emerges, also by Clarity Press, last October. So if you want to read about how this new financial imperialism works, where the bigger economies create customs union, free trade zones, and banking unions, and use it to squeeze surplus out of the smaller countries, read my book. Or you can get a review of it online on my blog and website, you know, jackrasmus.com. And from there you can go to the website. You can read the book review, recent review of the book. Also, you can go to Clarity Press and, you know, the reviews and commentaries and so forth are there. If you're particularly interested in Europe and the periphery in Europe, and Greece as a most extreme case example of this new kind of emerging financial imperialism, where you know, it's not the colonialist conquering a country and setting up production and paying people minimum wages or controlling their currency and banking union, so the goods, real goods, get sent back to the host colonial conqueror country, and they resell it at higher prices. You know, that's the old classic British imperialism. You know, it's how they ran their empire and India and elsewhere, and squeezed the value out of everything that people produced in those areas, in those colonies, and shifted it all back to Britain and enjoyed the largesse, the British capitalist class. Well, it doesn't work that way anymore, you see. We have a new kind of imperialism. It's not even the old American imperialism, which function by not creating a political bureaucracy to run the country. That's expensive. You know, you cut a deal with the indigenous capitalist class here, and you share in the proceeds, and you send your companies into those countries to exploit those countries and those workers there. And that's much more efficient, much more profitable, you know, the American 20th century form of imperialism. And if there's a problem, you know, you always have the Marines in the corner ready to go, you know, to invade, you know, Guatemala and Nicaragua, whatever, all these places, Caribbean, et cetera. You know, you work with your CIA and others to destabilize if it looks like popular uprisings are going to overthrow the indigenous capitalist class, like in occurred in Chile and places like that, you know, and what they're trying to pull off now again in Venezuela. You know, that's 20th century capitalism. The new capitalism, 21st century capitalism, is, you know, you don't even have to send companies, multinational companies, to produce in those countries anymore. You just loan them money and you indebt them, put them in debt and make them pay interest payments. You know, you just keep sucking off the interest payments on previous loans made to these indigenous capitalist class. And, you know, when they get out of line, you get the IMF to pull the plug on them. And you wreck their economy, and you threaten, in doing that, the popular uprising. So, you know, their indigenous capitalist class just plays ball with you. You know, this is imperialism by Goldman Sachs, you see. This is the way it's done increasingly in the 21st century. Well, anyway, that's you know, Greece is a case example of that in Europe. All right, so what else has happened globally of interest here? Well, Brazil, mass protests, uprisings. You know, they had a legal coup there where the elites and conservative and economic elites got rid of the president of the Workers' Party there, Rousseff, a little over a year ago, by cooking up this thing about corruption in the oil company there, and they put their capitalists in power here. This guy Temer, right? And now it's pretty obvious that he was the crooked one. You know, how did they get people to go along? Well, they engineered an economic crisis. The Brazilian Central Bank raised interest rates to 14%, brought the economy to a halt, mass unemployment, right? Collapsed the currency, which meant all the imports, inflation, so you get massive inflation and massive unemployment. People get discontent. You distract them by saying, it's a corruption in the ruling people's parties here. You throw them out. You use CIA money and other resources enact a legal coup, and you throw them out and you take over. Well, you know, this guy Temer took over here, and now it's found out he's even more corrupt than the claims of corruption levied against the previous Workers' Party that was in power there. So Brazil mass protests now. Latest event last week was tens of thousands marching on the Capitol and threatening to surround the parliament there and the president. So this guy Temer, you know, the acting president, calls off the army now to stop the protest. Ooh, this is becoming a very touchy situation, you know, when you're going to use the army to prevent protesters who want to encircle the White House and the Capitol, to use an analogy, just envision that. Now, that's a pretty serious situation. Well, you know, the Brazilian working class is not putting up with it. And now it's becoming clear to many what this thing was all about, right? We got a similar program that was pushed to get rid of, these quasi-democratic parties in Argentina, pulled off a similar coup, very same to what happened in Brazil. You know, it's a new strategy. You know, you claim corruption. The CIA gives you all the information you need and leads you and shows you how to do it and provides finances and so forth for your insurrection party here, your corporate insurrection party, and helps you in, you know, behind the scenes to overthrow these elected governments, or when elections come out, to create such a corruption scandal that people get confused and they vote themselves out. Well, same thing happened in Argentina. And the first thing that the new Argentina president did was to come to Washington and to say that Argentina would pay the vulture capitalists, the American vulture capitalists, you know, the hedge fund guys and so forth, you know, the Singers, Paul Singers and so forth, because the previous government refused to pay them for the speculative loans that they made earlier in the 2000 decade that caused, Argentina and Brazil to collapse. So they weren't going to pay these hedge fund guys. And the hedge fund guys just continued fighting against for a decade here until they get their people in. And, of course, this Argentine guy, first thing he does is run to Washington and says, okay, we'll pay you the $5 billion or whatever it was. We'll pay your hedge fund guys, you know. But, and in exchange for that, they get at least the $5 billion more in loans, which most of these guys just suck off the top and for themselves here, you know, the new Argentine business elite. Anyway, mass protests there may spill over to Argentina. We'll see. And of course, the fight, similar, more down and dirty fight, goes on in Venezuela, trying to destabilize, and with some success, destabilize that economy from afar, from Washington, which has been the case there as well. Another interesting development of the past week, warnings on the China corporate debt getting out of control. In my new book, I have the chapter on China and called "The People's Bank of China Chases Its Shadows." Shadows here meaning shadow bankers. Mm-hmm. China has been in a running battle with these speculators and shadow bankers since 2011. In some ways, it's losing the battle. Anyway, the debt in China, you know, is a problem. 260% of gross domestic product now, up from 130% in 2008. So they've doubled the level of their total debt in China, trying to battle these shadow bankers and keep the economy growing at the same time. Goldman Sachs put out a report recently that said the total corporate debt in China now is 214 trillion renminbi. That's the currency, you see, yuan renminbi. At an exchange rate of 6.8%, that's about $32 trillion, the corporate sector. I'm not talking about the government in China, you know, which is not anywhere near that level of debt, or households, which is not anywhere near that level of debt. I'm talking about the corporate sector, and the corporate sector heavily, not just the banks, but all these shadow banks and all these industrial enterprise companies and all of these cities and localities, government, you know, municipal sectors and so forth, massive debt going on there. How long can you pay that debt? You know, how long can you service that debt is an interesting question. All right. Anyway, we'll probably be talking more about China debt when we have our series here on central banks. Federal Reserve, as I said, is going to soon announce a rate increase here. That's a done deal. It won't be the first of three. It will be the last in 2017 because the economy is going to weaken. Okay. And, of course, last week we had the House revising its ACA bill. You know, the Obamacare, remember that? Yeah. Came out that, 26 million people were going to be thrown out of health insurance coverage of any kind here. as a result of the Republican Paul Ryan, really, Paul Ryan's bill, and that raised a bit of a furor, and the House went back to revise it. Well, there's no change in this revised ACA bill. It's pretty, you know, they just moved the money around, you know, they like checkers, you know, they move things from this part to this part, and you know, there's no real change in the House bill. It still proposes gutting $800 billion from Medicaid, which is, you know, the program that disabled people rely on, that single mothers, mothers with, you know, single heads of household with kids, that the poor rely on, that the disabled rely on. You know, this is bare bones medical coverage. You know, anyone on Medicaid knows that it's bare bones. You know, you don't get the best doctors. You can't get into regular doctors. You've got to go to clinics. At least it's something, you see. It's not the kind of coverage average folks get, but it's something, instead of just running to emergency rooms. So, you know, they want to cut that $800 billion. Yes. Got to, you know, cut these poor folks, you know. And that's part of the revised ACA bill. And at the same time, you say you got to cut that $800 billion out so you can continue giving tax cuts. Under the Obamacare, you see, businesses had to pay $592 billion over a decade here in tax hikes. So if you're going to gut it, according to the House bill, and eliminate all those tax hikes on corporations, businesses, and investors, and the wealthy, they're the ones who are paying the tax hikes to finance, in part, Obamacare, which included the big Medicaid improvements. So you got to, if you're going to cut $592 billion, you know, you got to cut at least that much in spending. So they're going to cut $800 billion in spending for Medicaid. You see, it's a take from the poor to give to the rich, you know, or sometimes called Robin Hood in reverse. We're seeing a lot of Robin Hood in reverse here with this Trump administration. Okay, and what else here last week of interest? Well, last session we talked about emerging U.S. economic potholes. In other words, all this hype about the U.S. economy and the Trump bump and everything. You know, what are the weak potholes and weak links beginning to appear that undermine this whole notion that we got a robust recovery coming? Well, we talked about those last week, but another interesting one that's a couple that have emerged here this past week is U.S. bank lending collapsing. Commercial and industrial loans, you know, that were growing at the beginning of 2016 at 10% annual rate, and that were averaging in previous years 9%. You know, bank loans increasing 9%. Well, if you're giving loans, then some of those loans are resulting in investment and job creation and so forth. Well, what's happened to bank lending here in 2017? It's virtually collapsed. You know, it's 0.2%. In the first quarter of this year, bank lending is stagnated. Well, if bank lending is stagnated, you know, there's not going to be a lot of investment and job creation, and therefore you're not going to have wage gains in 2017, equal even to the tepid gains that had occurred before. And at the same time, without wage gains, we've got inflation going, so real wages are going to decline, and consumption in the U.S. is in trouble unless people keep borrowing more to fund their consumption, which they probably will do, right? Anyway, economists still claim that despite this bank lending collapse and all the other pothole indicators, that we're still going to get 2.2% GDP growth this year. That's crazy, you know? with the economy having grown the last 6 months, last two consecutive quarters of only 0.7%, 0.2%. I mean, what tea leaves are these guys looking at? New home sales are down 11.4%. Here, previous home sales down 2.3%. Jobless claims indications are beginning to rise. You know, the problem with these economists and their forecasts is that they forecast the past. You see, they don't forecast the future. They just look at the past and they, you know, crank in some silly assumptions about a whole number of things and say, okay, what's my colleague forecasting? Oh, he's forecasting 2. Okay, I'll forecast 1.9 or 2.1. You see, they all look at each other, try to play it safe. Okay, so that's the round robin here, as we've been calling it on the show, of recent events the past week. Let's move on to the Trump budget itself. Okay. Earlier this year, Trump came out with his one-pager budget. Remember that one? Yeah. Just throw something out over the transom there, right? Here, take a look. This is what I'm going. I'm doing something. I'm doing something here, you know? I mean, everything else is being blocked. You know, my immigration bill, I can't get my wall passed, and all the other nonsense that he's proposed, right? So he threw out this one-pager, and it called for a $54 billion increase in defense in the next fiscal year, funded by a $54 billion cut in programs, you know, mostly education, health, and so forth, right? But he didn't have any tax details in that one-pager, and people called him on that. So, you know, he threw another one-pager over the transom there on this tax deals, his tax proposals, which called for $2.2 trillion cuts in taxes. You know, most of them corporate tax. We reduced the corporate tax from 35% to 15%. You know, and all their host of other tax cuts for the rich and corporations and businesses and the 1%, you know. Didn't say how we're going to pay for that, but, you know, the sort of implication is how are we going to balance that $2.2 trillion cuts for the rich? Well, we're going to do it by taking it from the middle class, you see. They're probably going to eliminate major exemptions and deductions, you know, like the state and local tax deduction and some other deductions. But there are no details there, you see, so it's hard to say. But what we can say about the $54 billion for defense and the financed by the tax spending cuts of $54 billion, Robin Hood for Lockheed and the Raytheon gang, that's what it is, right? Another example of Robin Hood economics here. You know, under Trump. Trumponomics is Robin Hood economics. And then Trump runs off and signs this $350 billion arms deal with the Saudis over the decade. $350 billion we're going to, you know, sell them. Well, Lockheed Raytheon, you know, jumping with joy at that one. What's going on there? Are they preparing a long-term military buildup to go to war with Iran? Could be. I mean, whoa. Why do the Saudis need that much military arms? I mean, you know, they bombed the hell out of Yemen already. Well, you know, there's nothing else to bomb there. What's it for? You know? There's some reason for it here. There's some reason. Long term, you know, not right now, maybe the fourth year of the Trump administration. We'll see what that means. If he gets that far, you know, he'll get to the 2018 midterm elections. After that, I don't know. You know, the other side of the U.S. economic and political elites are pretty upset with him. And, you know, the only thing that's saving him so far is his promise to give him big tax cuts. And, you know, they'll want to get that cattle in the corral before they actually go after him. They'll build the case before, you know, all this Russia connection and so forth, Flynn and so forth, is going to take some time. But the Republicans who are running both houses of Congress will not turn on him so long as they are expecting him to deliver. And we'll see if after 2018 midterms. Okay. So, that was the preliminary budget, Budget 1.0, one-pager, right? And a one-pager in tax cuts. Now, this past week, we get more of a detail in the formal budget released, and some very interesting stuff, in that we'll talk about here, right? But to understand budgets, you have to understand a couple background things to understand American budget, U.S. budget details. One is called the twin deficits. What do I mean by twin deficits? This is an essential element of neoliberalism, which originated with Ronald Reagan, you see. What are the twin deficits? Up until Reagan got into office, the U.S., ran modest trade deficit. Trade deficit is where we import more than we export. And modest budget deficit, that's where we take in taxes and revenues and spending on the other side of the ledger. They were modest. They weren't significant. But ever since Reagan, we have a ballooning of trade deficits and budget deficits, ballooning. And that's been occurring ever since 1981, again, bigger and bigger, long-run trend here. Bigger trade deficits. In other words, we import far, far more than we export to the rest of the world, and it's true everywhere, you see. It's not just located in China or in Europe or whatever, Japan. We run trade deficits with everybody. And that's part of the consequence of free trade. Free trade deals are designed for the U.S. to run deficits. That's the purpose. We will, the essence of these free trade deals is the U.S. Will buy more from you than you have to buy from us. That creates a trade deficit. And, American business goes along with it because when we say buy from you, from these other countries, what we're really saying is we're going to be buying from our own multinational corporations, because part of free trade is financial flows. And the whole idea is to allow U.S. companies to set up shop in these other countries and then ship the stuff back to us. So we're buying stuff from American companies that have moved offshore. And by the way, we're giving them big tax cuts to move offshore in the meantime. So free trade creates these deficits, and that's an objective of free trade. They know this is going to happen, and they know it's going to end up creating trade deficits. But here's the twist. That's one of the twin deficits, the trade deficit. The other is the budget deficit, because part of these deals, these free trade deals, is that the countries that are going to run a trade surplus at our expense, in other words, sell more to us, are going to get an accumulation of U.S. dollars. You see, we buy the stuff from them with our dollars. Right? When you go to Walmart, you're buying stuff from China. 85% of stuff that Walmart sells comes from China. I guess that makes it a Chinese company. In any event, that the dollars accumulate over in China. You see, when Walmart buys something or sells goods made in China, it's got to take the dollars, your dollars, and it's got to go back, and it's got to pay the Chinese companies that are making the T-shirts and tennis shoes, whatever. To pay those factories, to pay their workers, Walmart's got to take the dollars and go to the Bank of China and exchange it for Chinese currency called the yuan, which it then pays to the producers over there. So the dollars accumulate in the central bank of these countries. And part of the agreement setting up these free trade deals and these trade deficits is that those countries who are now accumulating dollars will recycle those dollars back to the U.S. How? that the central banks will buy U.S. treasuries, treasury bonds and bills and so forth, and to some extent maybe even buy into other infrastructure and so forth. But the idea is that money will be recycled. Those dollars that accumulate offshore as a result of free trade will be recycled back to the U.S. Treasury. Now, if the U.S. Treasury is getting massive, hundreds of billions of dollars a year by purchasings of its treasuries, it's accumulating all this payment. They're buying treasury bonds. That allows the U.S. government to run a budget deficit. Right? Budget deficit is just the difference between your spending and your tax revenues. Right? The U.S. government every year runs a budget deficit of $500 billion to $1 trillion. In other words, it has plans to spend $500 billion more than it takes in tax revenues in the U.S. Okay? If I'm going to have this inflow of $500 billion from buying treasuries every year, I can run a budget deficit. The inflow will cover the deficit. In fact, the inflow is so great because of free trade and trade deficit that I can actually, have a bigger budget deficit. I can cut taxes on the rich even more because the money's going to flow back. And, at the same time, I can actually go to war and not have to raise taxes. And that's exactly what the U.S. has been doing for two decades now, right? It's been engaging in this massive war spending, trillions of dollars, mostly in the Middle East, the whole Pentagon budget. The real budget, by the way, is closer to $1 trillion, not the $560 billion. That's just the Pentagon. The war spending, defense spending is distributed among different departments, not just the Pentagon. I can have a war, perpetual war since 2001, costing trillions and trillions of dollars without having to raise taxes. This is the first time in U.S. history that we've ever gone to war without raising taxes to some extent. We've actually cut taxes as we increase defense spending. Well, you can do this, and you can have this cause a budget deficit, huge budget deficits, because when you reduce your tax revenues, tax cuts, you're reducing your increasing your deficit. You see, and when you increase defense spending by leaps and bounds, you're increasing your deficit. Well, as long as they keep buying our bonds and the money flows back from the trade deficit, we can keep doing this. And in fact, it because it's been flowing back, the U.S. Has had a great incentive. The corporate elites running the government have great incentives to give even more and more tax cuts to the rich and their companies, while spending even more and more on defense and wars. Okay, and by the way, you use the excuse of the deficit before you get the money coming back to go and attack social programs in the meantime. It's a nice arrangement that they've developed. It's part of neoliberalism, you see. This is the connection between neoliberal tax policies and neoliberal war policies and neoliberal trade policies. It's a nice arrangement that they worked out for themselves, ever since Reagan in the 1980s. By the way, I talk about this twin deficit idea in the book Looting Greece. As an example of how the U.S. has set up restructured its dominance of the global economy after Reagan in 1980. I explain this, this twin deficit because Europe, when they formed the Eurozone and the Euro currency, and the European Central Bank and so forth in 1999, attempted to create a similar twin deficit arrangement in which Germany and Northern Europe and the bankers there would similarly dominate the periphery of Europe and get the money recycled back. Anyway, I don't want to go into details here, but Chapter 2 of Looting Greece describes this whole process. internally within Europe. You know, like a mini twin deficit deal, but it hasn't worked out very well because the euro is not as powerful as the dollar. Anyway, to understand the, I'm running out of time. I'm sorry, I'm talking too much about the backgrounds here about the Trump budget, but let me try to accelerate this. Right, the U.S. deficit, you know, is caused people don't understand mostly by a decline in tax revenue. 60% of the deficits and therefore the U.S. debt is the consequence of tax cuts and reduced tax revenue. Right, $3.7 trillion under Bush, $5.3 trillion under Obama in tax cuts. Right, and Trump now has proposed $2.8 trillion so far for a total since 2003. Of $11.5 trillion in tax cuts, mostly for businesses, investors, and the like. 40% of the deficits are due to spending. War spending, about $3 to $4 trillion. And increased government spending for the healthcare system, as healthcare insurance companies and other providers are gouging the hell out of everybody. And then some bailouts, you know. Social spending on the 2008 crisis and bailouts for unemployment and SNAP and bailing out the auto companies and the banks and so forth, and financing Part D Medicare prescription drug program in 2005 under George Bush, for which we raised no taxes whatsoever. We pay it totally out of deficits. And, of course, the pharma companies are gouging the hell out of government and everybody with their price increases. You know, so these are the origins of the U.S. deficits and debt. So here comes the Trump budget, and big cuts in health care and education, you know, trying to privatize education, right? He claims no reductions in Social Security and Medicare yet. You see, that's coming. That's the next phase. They don't dare include in their first budget and cuts attacking Social Security and Medicare because it would derail it immediately. So they're holding that off. They'll come with that later. And what's Trump doing? He's claiming he's going to balance the budget by 2026 because these tax cuts are going to result and, you know, the spending cuts and the tax cuts are both going to result in deregulation, result in raising real gross domestic product in the U.S. to 3 to 3.5%. You know, it's really been growing officially about 2.1. Actually, it's about 1.8, well below historic averages. And these tax cuts are going to boost tax revenues. This is all supply-side bullshit. Supply-side theory bullshit that's been going on since Reagan that argues if you cut taxes, you're going to raise tax revenues because you're going to stimulate economic investment and economic growth that's going to bring in even more revenue than you cut in revenue with your tax cuts, you see. This is bullshit. It doesn't work. There's no historical proof and evidence of this working. But this is what Trump's whole budget is based upon, raise GDP to 3% plus, $2 trillion more revenue is going to come in. Absurd assumption. Tax cuts will produce even more tax revenues. Nonsense. Right? So he's going to cut corporate and investor taxes by $2.2 trillion, but he's saying this is going to generate $2 trillion more in revenue. Well, independent estimates are that the tax cuts are going to reduce revenue by $5 trillion and not generate revenue by $2 trillion. When challenged with this budget director, Mulvaney said, quote, I'm simply not in a position to go into more details, unquote. Yes, right? So he's going to cut discretionary social programs by 41%, not including defense, which is going to get the money, right, according to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. And somehow, magically, we're going to get this increase in revenues, right? Here's how absurd it gets. You know, in the budget proposal, he proposes to eliminate the state inheritance taxes altogether. Going to be gone. It brings in a lot of revenue. But at the same time, he argues, by reducing, by eliminating estate taxes altogether, that's going to generate estate tax revenue by $300 billion. Well, how do you generate anything when you eliminate something? That's how absurd the logic is here in this whole program. Another absurd assumption, right? Eliminate a tax to get a greater increase from the tax, right? Of course, he doesn't say that, you know, cutting this to $2.2 trillion may be offset not just by spending, social spending program cuts, but by raising taxes or eliminating tax deductions for the middle class. That's there. Oh, but, you know, and we're not going to get into details. Or as Treasury Secretary Mnuchin replied to criticism this past week, you know, well, quote, the details may be wrong, but the bottom line is that it's right. Yeah, go figure that one. Absurd assumptions about budget tax cuts will lead to 3% GDP hikes, right, and generate $2.1 trillion in more revenue. Well, others have looked at the budget proposal here, and what do they see in it? They see that this 3%, $2.1 trillion, has been counted twice. That's how incompetent this whole budget is. It's like, you know, they've been throwing slapdash this thing together, you know, in the first preliminary one-pager, and now this one isn't much better, and it's got all these contradictions in it. And it's not even done, you know, adequately. It's not even written, described adequately. I mean, it's a joke. You know? It's a joke. This whole budget proposal is a joke, except it's not funny for the folks in education and healthcare and so forth who are going to suffer massive, massive program spending cuts. People are going to die because of this budget if it ever gets enacted. But, you know, corporations and the wealthy and the 1% are going to, you know, be singing on the way to the bank, you know, trillions of dollars of additional tax cuts. Boy, this is really, you know, Robin Hood looks like a piker here. The, you know, this Robin Hood in reverse. It's really incredible what's going on. Well, this is going to be a big boon for increasing income inequality in this country. Now, this is going to ratchet it up even more so than ever before. And, you know, it's all based on this Reagan ridiculous supply-side crap. If you cut taxes, it'll generate more investment, more spending, and therefore more tax revenues. This is the best they can come up with, and they're going to, you know, they're going to keep talking about, oh, this is a job creator, this is a job creator, you know. Every tax cut, corporate investor tax cut since Bush 2001 has been labeled a tax, a job creation bill. Every one, and they'll probably call, you know, this $2.2 trillion thing going through Congress now, a job creation bill. But none of it has created any jobs. Jobs have declined. Investment has declined. Productivity is falling. When the U.S. is stagnant, right? Real investment has been declining. Bank lending is going nowhere, stagnant now. And they're claiming it's going to create jobs. There's no evidence. We've never gotten the jobs back in construction and manufacturing that we had. It's all lies, but, you know, the Trump administration's pretty good at lying. And that's what we see with this budget, just another big lie. Okay, next week we're going to start with our central bankers at the end of their ropes series. This is Alternative Visions.